It's 1240. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. As we come to the end of a tumultuous week of global economic news, we have seen rising share prices in Asia and the euro close to a three-week high. As NPR's Philip Reeves reports, markets are encouraged by reports that the world's central banks have come up with a plan to try to calm panic in the eurozone.
Investors have a lot to worry about right now. They're worried about Sunday's elections in Greece and whether these will eventually lead to a Greek exit from the eurozone. They're worried that Spain might need another bailout and that contagion will sweep into debt-laden Italy, the eurozone's third largest economy. Anxiety and turbulence in the eurozone has helped make this a volatile week on the markets. Global central banks are bracing themselves for worse and are moving to avert market panic ahead of the Greek vote. Reports say they're preparing to take coordinated action to stabilize the financial markets by providing liquidity. Recession-hit Britain has already started. The Bank of England, along with the government, are to give the equivalent of tens of billions of dollars in cheap loans to banks to try to get them lending to businesses again. The bank is also activating an emergency liquidity plan and will soon begin pumping $8 billion a month into the financial system. Bank of England Governor Mervyn King unveiled these moves with an extraordinarily bleak speech. He said a large black cloud of uncertainty is hanging over the eurozone and the world economy.
The black cloud has dampened animal spirits so that businesses and households are battening down the hatches to prepare for the storms ahead.
Flip Reeves, NPR News, London.
China has seen its economic growth slow more so than people had expected. To try and spur growth, Beijing has cut interest rates for the first time since the depths of the global financial crisis. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Shanghai on some of the economic developments that have generated headlines around the world.
Simply put, the world's second largest economy is running out of steam.
There's something of a cloud hanging over China's previously booming economy.
One advisor to China's leadership calls it a sharp slowdown.
Those were some of the headlines last week, and they followed some concerning figures. In May, consumer prices fell well below government targets. This week, the head of a Chinese government think tank said growth from April through June could drop below 7%. Weakness has been showing up in various corners of the economy, including air travel.
I'm Brian Pierce. I'm the chief economist at the International Air Transport Association.
Pierce was in Beijing this week for the association's annual conference. He says air travel here has been hit pretty hard.
For a number of years, we were seeing growth rates of 15-20%. That seems to have slowed down quite sharply over the last year, and we're seeing growth rates down to single figures, which is quite strong for most markets, but for China, that's a pretty weak outcome.
Most travel in China is for business, and many business people are anxious.
Confidence has been weaker, particularly amongst smaller businesses, and also export business has weakened. So China has seen exports to Europe fall quite sharply because of the problems in Europe.
When people talk about China's economy, they often focus on exports. But most of the things driving the current decline are homegrown.
The slowdown that the Communist Party promised is underway.
Andy Rothman is China macro strategist for CLSA, an independent brokerage and investment group. He says China's blistering growth is no longer sustainable. The government has been trying to slow it down and improve its quality. The problem, Rothman says, the Communist Party overdid it.
The government tightened up a little bit too much in two areas, in the housing market and on construction of public infrastructure.
The government put restrictions on real estate sales to bring down sky-high prices, but driving down sales also helped drive down demand for things like steel and concrete, and it hurt factories. The government is now quietly encouraging some home buying and approving new public projects to help stabilize the economy. Last month, home sales picked up in major cities. Rothman is generally upbeat.
We've got kind of a typical situation in China where things don't work perfectly well, but then the government comes in and fixes it pretty quickly. And now I think we're back on track to get just over 8% growth this year, which is what we'd expected at the start of the year.
If you ask me just to look at the next 6 months, I'm optimistic because everybody is in panic mode now.
Rian Shenfeng is senior analyst with IHS Global Insight in Beijing.
But more pessimistic about the medium and longer term.
Ren says that's because China's economy needs serious reform. To keep growth going, the government needs to build a more innovative economy, one where it doesn't favor state-owned companies so much and does more to help finance private firms, which create most of the jobs here anyway.
If the government doesn't do anything to reform the current system, Chinese economy will be stuck in this structural downshift for quite some time, for many, many years.
After decades of spectacular growth, that would be a shock and something no one wants to see. Frank Langford, NPR News, Shanghai.
This Sunday marks the 40th anniversary of a bungled burglary at a Washington, D.C. hotel. Yep, you guessed it, Watergate. It led to the downfall of a president, and one Illinois historian says we're still feeling the impact of it today. Illinois Public Radio's Rich Egger has more.
Initially, most Americans considered the break-in at the Watergate to be a non-story. It appeared to be nothing more than political shenanigans, and Republicans managed to keep it off the front pages in advance of the presidential election. But the story did not go away. Richard Philippink of Western Illinois University's History Department says that's because there was a lot more to it.
As Nixon knew right from the outset, this was real potential trouble. The Nixon administration had engaged in this kind of behavior before. Indeed, this was the actual second successful break-in at Watergate. They had planted bugs initially and photographed documents a couple weeks earlier and had tried to break in two previous times. They also had two unsuccessful break-in attempts at McGovern's headquarters. So it's not just an isolated incident, and it's part of this sort of pattern of behavior that the Nixon administration felt that people were their enemies. And if you were their enemies, they had the right to do whatever they had to bring you into line.
What were these burglars seeking this time during this break-in at the Watergate?
Well, part of the second break-in was to fix bugs placed in the first break-in. One of them wasn't actually working. As to their actual motives, there's a whole host of potential reasons. Most of them were political. Some of them were personal for Nixon.
Did Nixon really need to do these types of things to win the election?
By that point, no. What you have to keep in mind is when these things were planned, Nixon was not doing very well in the polls. That for most of 1971, Nixon was seen as a potential one-term president. That as late as January of 72, Gallup polls had him running in a dead heat with the Democratic frontrunner Edmund Muskie. So in the immediate weeks after that Gallup poll is when this program was planned. When G. Gordon Liddy met with John Mitchell, the head of Nixon's campaign, and talked about what would become known as Operation Gemstone, the intelligence and dirty tricks campaign. And so at the time they were being planned, these seemed necessary. By June, not so much. By June, George McGovern's the front runner. He's the person that Nixon wants to run against. And so it's not seemingly as necessary. That said, some of those dirty tricks helped put McGovern in that place. It had influenced who the Democrats chose. So yes and no.
How do you think Watergate still affects us today, does it?
It does. It turns it into an era of hyperpartisanship. Prior to this point, if you read about relations among senators and among congressmen, with a handful of exceptions, they at least accepted that members of the other party were doing what was best for America. They may not agree with their positions and stances, but at least you agreed that we were all working for the same goal, which Nixon did as president and then as ex-president is emphasize the politics of division. That's Nixon's stock and trade, that you're not just my opponent, you're my enemy. You're not just wrong, you're evil. And so that bringing that to the table and bringing that to the fore becomes an integral part of American politics through to today, that you can't work together, that if you agree to compromise, you're betraying the cause.
Do you think the Republican attacks on Bill Clinton are a response to Watergate? Hey, you got one of our guys, so we have to get one of yours now.
I think that's absolutely the case. If you think about some of the people who were involved in those attacks, in particular in the Senate side, Trent Lott, he's a member of the House. He's one of the last people who said that he won't vote for Nixon's impeachment because you never vote for your own party's president to be impeached. And so, yes, there is definitely a sense of you got one of ours, we got one of yours, and that's part of Nixon's legacy.
Would you say Richard Nixon was his own worst enemy?
Absolutely. Nixon had those inner demons that drove him throughout his life, the same things that made him ambitious enough and self-confident enough to become president of the United States also drove him to, again, see anybody who's an opponent as an enemy, to have deep and abiding hatreds, to have deep and abiding grudges, and to never, ever let them go.
Historian Richard Philippink says it's important to remember that President Richard Nixon was involved in Watergate from the start. Philippink says Nixon might not have planned the break-in, but he was aware it happened and took charge of the cover-up. Rich Egger reporting.
Thanks to your support this year, the news and information you value is here every day.
With Illinois Public Media News, I'm Jeff Bossert.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason.
For Illinois Public Media News, I'm Sean Powers.
Support your source for balanced news and information, and follow our progress on WILL.illinois.edu.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 15th of June, 2012. It's the birthday of advertising exec-turned-writer Eileen Beckerman, born in Manhattan, 1935, who did not begin her writing career until the age of 60, and even then became a published author almost by accident. She had written and illustrated a book for her five children, Something to Remember Her By. She said, "My purpose was to say things to my children one doesn't have the time to say. I wanted them to know I wasn't always their mother. I was a girl. I had best friends. We did stupid things together. I was on a bus with my friend once, eating dog bones so people would look at us. I wanted them to know." She took the book that she had written down to the ad agency that she owned to use the photocopy machine there, and she put the copies in big red binders with illustrations that she had sketched in plastic sheet protectors, and she handed them out to her children and a few close friends, and she was done, or thought she was. But the cousin of a friend got hold of one of the binders and sent it over to Algonquin Books, and pretty soon they were calling her about publishing the thing. Beckerman said they offered her an advance that had a comma in it. I think I fainted. The book came out in 1995. It was called Love, Loss, and What I Wore, the story of growing up in Manhattan in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, accompanied by drawings of the clothes that she was wearing during that time. When the book came out, bookstores weren't sure whether to market it as memoir or fashion, but it's now sold over 100,000 copies. Beckerman said that clothes were the least important part of her book, which she considered a memoir. The book containing advice from her grandmother who raised her,